Okay, well, as you guys know, we went through last week and had a very interesting week. And so when I got home, really rushed, we had another little mini crisis come up after we got home. And so what I did is I just decided last night I would just take and write down my experiences and show some things that sort of helped me and some lessons that I've learned over the past, basically the last 5 months. Since I found out that my brother had died. So I'm just going to share with you the story, a few more details than what we've had in the past. And I've got a few slides up here, so maybe we can turn the lights off or some of them off or something so we can go through. And I'm just going to sit down and read a lot of this stuff if it's okay, be a little bit more casual. But I'm calling this the finger of God, and you're going to see why here as we go on. So anyway, here we go. This past week I've experienced one of the most spiritually awakening events I've ever experienced. And as most of you know, I myself, as well as many of you, have been praying for many weeks about me being able to find the whereabouts of my brother. And you know, my brother committed suicide. My younger brother, his name is Keith, and he was somewhat of a loner, but he was a very adventurous loner. At age 17, he left home and headed for the mountains of Colorado and eventually hiked, from what I understand, the entire Colorado portion of the Continental Divide. And we crossed, Angie and I crossed the Continental Divide last week a couple of times, and it's up there. It's way up there. But he did this by himself at about age 17 or 18, from all the way from New Mexico up to Wyoming. During his late 30s or early 40s, he took and single-handedly sailed a trimaran. That's a sailboat with three hulls. He single-handedly sailed this thing from Seattle, Washington, down to Costa Rica and back. And it's quite a feat for a single person to do, or one person. And then years later, after he sold his boat, years later he took and traveled most of Europe all by himself. So he was quite an adventurer, but he was sort of a loner, and he stayed by himself. But he eventually did get married, and was married for about 10 years. But when my brother Keith, at age 50, his eyes started going bad, and he had a disease called macular degeneration. And what it does, it takes away the central focus of your eyes. You can see things in the peripheral vision, but you can't see stuff straight ahead. And because his vocation was a builder, and because he was a perfectionist, when he built houses, he often did all the trim work himself because he wanted it done a certain way. And so having this macular degeneration, it got to where he couldn't see his saws and stuff like that, and got to be where he was not able to do the job quite the way he wanted to do it. But he was very concerned about his retirement. He knew his eyes were going bad, and because he was concerned about his retirement, he invested in a number of rental properties, and he did this in the early 2000s when the economy was cooking right along. But subsequently, as years progressed, in about 2006, he basically, because of everything sort of tanked in the real estate market, he found himself upside down on all of his houses, which of course meant that he owed more than the houses were actually worth. And because of all the rental properties and all the houses going on the market at that time, his rents subsequently went down as well. And because the rents went down, he found himself having to start making payments out of his own pocket on the houses to subsidize the lower rents in order to be able to hold on to his houses. So he had a lot of problems. And then, of course, one of the big problems he had is he had a problem with depression. And depression is something that can affect persons in different ways. But depression is really hard on a single person, because when you're single, you just don't have anybody to talk to and work these things through. And my brother's depression is actually what caused he and his first wife to split up. And it wasn't that they were having any problems between themselves or anything like that. It was simply the fact that when he got on these depressive bouts, he found the only way to get out of it was to take and go up into the mountains and camp. And so when he had a fit of depression, he would go up in the mountains and camp for sometimes 2 or 3 days, sometimes a week, week and a half. And after having these things, he felt so bad about it that he just felt like he was dragging his wife through something that she didn't deserve. And so eventually he just asked her to leave. And it wasn't anything else. It was just simply the depression that got to him. So she left. She was from England, and she moved back to England. As all these problems came together, and out of his desire to not be a burden on anybody, Keith decided that he was going to end his life. And he had talked about this a number of times in the past, but he apparently was more serious this time. And he went out and bought a gun, and went out to the middle of the Colorado desert, and basically ended his life. But before doing so, he stated that he was going to do this in a place that he would never be found. He told my oldest brother, don't come looking for me. You'll never find me where I'm going to go. And so he headed out on a Thursday afternoon, apparently, and parked his truck out in the middle of the desert and ended his life. Months later, his truck was found by the sheriff's department as they were just making a routine pass of the area looking for hunters and stuff who might be in distress or something. And they saw his truck out there. They saw a truck out there that, and they noticed it had been out there for a little while, so they called the Department of Motor Vehicles and found out that the truck belonged to the missing person who was suspected of committing suicide. Of course, that was my brother. And so they reported that. They contacted my oldest brother and told him that they had found his truck. And my brother went out there and picked up the truck. And I would suppose, though I'm not for sure, my brother asked, you know, what's the likelihood of finding him? And what the sheriff's department said was that when they were out there, in fact, they reiterated this to me, when they were out there, when they discovered the truck and they realized that this was the truck that had belonged to a suicidal person, they brought an army of about 15 to 20 people out, and they searched for 2 days trying to find him, and they couldn't find him anywhere. So they, due to financial restrictions in that county, they had to call off the search, and so no search went on after that. When I was told that my brother was going to commit suicide, I didn't really believe it was going to happen because he talked about it before. He was very very discouraged by our current president, discouraged about the way he saw things going in this country, and so he would talk about it. But he never ever did anything. Plus, Keith had a history of being gone. He would take and just sort of vanish. You would see him and you'd talk with him, and then his phone would be disconnected, and then you wouldn't hear from him for a period of a year, 2 years or something. So when my oldest brother Mike said that he thinks that Keith's committed suicide, I said, no, he didn't commit suicide. He's just off someplace. He's probably in Canada. You know, he hated what's going on down here, so he probably just moved up to Canada. And he said, he'll turn up someday. Don't worry about it. But my whole family believed that he had committed suicide, and so they arranged to have a memorial service for him in, was it December? December of last year. And in that memorial service, of course, they all were saddened about him dying. And I said, you know, guys, he's not dead, you know, and all that. But then my sister told me, just as we were getting ready to leave from up there, she told me about my brother and his problems with his ex-wife. Apparently his ex-wife, she had held out hopes of them getting back together, but Keith kept her pushed off. And then Keith, about three years ago, tried to rekindle the relationship, and for some reason they weren't able to rekindle it. And so when she got back to England, she filed for divorce. And he was served with the divorce papers in January of 2011. And then he came. My sister and my older brother and myself and my mother all met at my sister's house in Kansas City in the summer of 2011 to sort of just get together. We hadn't been together in a long time, so we decided to come together. And Keith was there with us. And after that meeting, Keith went back home. He decided he was going to try to rekindle the relationship with a girlfriend that he had, who he had basically pushed away again because of his depression problems. And when he called her and talked to her, he found out that she was engaged to get married. And I didn't know all this, but apparently it was 3 days later that he committed suicide after this girl told him that she was engaged. So obviously that was the straw that broke the camel's back for my brother, and which caused him to go ahead and commit suicide. In our fellowship over the last few years, we've talked a lot about a number of things, and one of those is that we are to be our brother's keeper. And you've heard me talk about this before in regards to Torah observance, building community and stuff like that. And it's something that has weighed pretty heavy on me over the years, that we should become our brother's keeper, not only in our family, but in our fellowship. And then we'd also seen that the firstborn of the families had tremendous responsibilities. We talked about that just a few weeks ago in regards to the priesthood and other things, but we've talked about that quite a bit. So when you combine those things together, that the firstborn have responsibilities and that we are to be our brother's keeper, it sort of came upon me that, you know, I need to probably do something about my brother. And I had come to the realization that he was dead, but what can I do for my brother? And then I also had been studying myself over the concept of, and we've seen this in our Torah studies, the concept of how God deals with the dead. And we have realized that through going through the Torah that God instructs Israel in regards to how to deal with the dead. And so, let me see, am I jumping ahead of myself? Okay, yeah, I guess I did jump ahead of myself there. Anyway, we studied and we realized that God intends for us to deal with the dead with dignity, because all human beings are children of God. No matter what your bent, what your problems, what your cultural intent or anything like that, we're all children of God. And so God intends for people to bury their dead. But the problem that we were facing in regards to my brother was that we didn't know where he was. We couldn't find him. The only clue he had given to us as to where his location was is that he drove his truck to a certain spot and left it. According to the sheriff, and so what I did is this, is I called up to Colorado about the 1st of January, and I called up there looking for a tracker, someone who'd track my brother. And so I got on the internet and I looked, and I couldn't see anything, but I saw it said tracker on there, and then it gave a phone number. So I called the phone number, and it was the San Miguel County Sheriff's Department, and which is just happened to be the Sheriff's Department that my brother's body was found in. So I called there and told them I was looking for a tracker, and they said, who are you wanting to track? And I told them that I got a brother I think had committed suicide up in Southwest Colorado. And she says, oh, we know about that. And she says, you need to talk to this guy or another guy. So she said, hang up and I'm going to have someone call you. So they had a guy call me, and his name was Chris White. And Chris was part of the San Miguel County Search and Rescue Department. And he told me that, he said, yeah, I know about your brother. He said, I was there, I was part of the search party that looked for him. And but he said, I'm really not the person you need to talk to. You need to talk to a fellow named Eric Berg. He's the guy in charge of the Search and Rescue Department here in San Miguel County. So Eric called me, and talked to me for nearly an hour there that day there in January. And he told me that he had found the truck, my brother's truck, 17 miles off the nearest road. It was on 17 miles of dirt road, that far off the nearest dirt road. And that the area that he was found in was surrounded by canyons and mesas, very rugged country. Said the mesas had boulders the size of semi-trucks. He says it's a big, big area there. And he says there's some very dangerous area to be in. So he said, you know, you can come up here and look if you want to come up here and look. But he says your chances of finding him are slim to none. But he told me about all the stuff that they had done to try to find him, and they said that they were able to find him. But he said, don't come up here now. There's snow on the ground. It's a muddy mess. You'll never get back in there. Like I said, 17 miles of dirt road. And as you get up there and you see that dirt is sort of powdery dirt, and so when you get water into it, it just turns into a goulash, you know. It's something terrible. So anyway, he said, you know, come on up, plan on coming up in May, and you can search for him for May. In May. So that's what led up to the point where I decided that, yeah, I want to find my body, my brother's body, but I'm not going to be able to do it on my own. And I knew the only way we would be able to do so is through prayer and for looking for God to actually guide us that way. So this begins the story of the search for my brother and the signs that led me to his body. So I want to break off here and talk a little bit about some things in Scripture. For many years, I had been taught and I had come to believe that it was wrong to ask God for signs. And how many of you have ever heard teachings that, you know, you shouldn't be asking for signs, okay? That it was wrong. Those who asked for signs were those who had little faith. True believers in God would simply fast, pray, and believe. But asking for signs was taboo. Only Jews and non-believers asked for signs. After all, didn't Paul say... And if I can find my clicker here, and if I can get, why is this doing this? There you go. For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness. So this is one of the passages that I remember being talked about that would indicate that we shouldn't be following and looking for signs. After all, only Jews look for signs. And as if asking for signs was a terrible thing. But is that actually what Paul was talking about? The text of the Scripture doesn't support that view, nor does the Tanakh. The Hebrew word for sign is the word ot. Ot. And it means a sign or a signal and a distinguishing mark. The first time and it comes from the root word ut, which means to consent or agree. To consent or agree. And then we can think, well, how does these two things come together? And as we go through this study, we'll be able to see how the word ut, sign, and actually has the connotation of being in agreement with something. The first time we see the root word oat is in the Dina incident, where she had a relationship with Shechem. And we all remember that story. We go through it every year. Dina was Jacob's daughter. Jacob had recently relocated his family to the area of Shechem and was a stranger, whereas Hamor, Shechem's father, was a native. So here you have Jacob coming into a land, he's the goy. He's the one who's a stranger in the land, basically, because the native of the land was Shechem, or Hamor. So here they are, and Dina, Jacob's daughter, and Shechem, Hamor's daughter, want to get married. So Hamor took it upon himself to say, and which is probably right, since it was his son wanting the daughter of a man. Hamor said, you know, I want my son to marry your daughter. What do I have to do, or what do we have to do in order for her to marry within your family, or in order for my son to marry within your family? So it was sort of a little bit different than what you would think. And what they said was, or what actually happened was that Jacob said that he would agree to allow his daughter to marry your son if your sons will all be circumcised like we are. And the word agree there is the word oath, sign. In fact, we'll see this right here. Genesis 34:15. But in this we will consent or oath unto you if you will be as we, that every male of you be circumcised. So what he's saying is that our consent, we will consent if you wear a sign. Because what is circumcision? It's a sign of the covenant. So here we have agreement being tied in with a sign. Actually, that was the word, I'm sorry. The word, which means agree or consent. The word oath, though, is used very early in the scripture. It's in Genesis 1:14. And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven, divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs or oath, and for seasons and for days and for years. Yahweh put the sun and the moon and the stars in the sky to keep things in agreement. You know, you can't have the festivals if you don't have the moon. And you can't have the yearly cycles. You can't have the plants coming. You can't have the barley ripening to be in line with the spring harvest if the barley doesn't agree with the signs that it sees, with the sun. So all of these things have to be in agreement. They have to be in agreement with the signs that God placed in the heaven for us to be able to participate in the walk that God gave us and in the worship. And as long as the animals and the plants and all the living creatures follow the signs, the sun, the moon, and the stars, then all things can be in agreement. So it's sort of a different way of looking what these things are all about. So God gives us signs for a specific purpose. God is not stingy with signs. One of the greatest signs, one of the signs that we're most thankful for as a people in general, no matter what background you are, is the sign that God said in regards to never being a flood again. In Genesis 9:12 says, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you, that for all future generations I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign or an oath of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh when the bow is in the clouds. I will see it and remember it, and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And as we can see in this case, the sign that God placed in the heaven, for whose benefit was it? It's for God's benefit. God is the one who says, I'm going to look at that sign, and I'm going to remember the covenant. So with that rainbow in the sky, there's a sign for God to see, and it reminds him that he's got a covenant with those of us on the earth. And of course, it is a benefit for us because we can look at it, and if we truly believe God, then we can believe that there won't be another flood to kill all the people on the earth. So God placed a sign in the sky for his own benefit. So if we are to not be dealing with signs, then God's breaking his own law, because this sign he placed there for his own purposes. And then there's a sign of circumcision, and this, of course, is a sign that God requires of his people. But it's a sign that for the children of Israel was something that in most cases, and if they had done it the way they were supposed to be doing it, then they didn't even have to apply the sign to themselves because it was applied to them by their fathers. I never heard of a boy being pre-circumcised, nor did I ever see situations where the older Israelites had to circumcise themselves except after they crossed into the land. So circumcision is just, it's another sign. It's a sign of the agreement that we have between God and ourselves that we are going to walk in your ways and you're going to bless us. I mean, it's really quite simple, but God did give us a sign for that benefit. So signs, there's nothing wrong with signs. Nothing at all wrong with signs if we look at what the scriptures say and believe what the scriptures say. I'm going to pass over this next one real quick. We'll get to it a little bit later. So dropping back to this story here, my search for Keith's remains started in January when I was told that I'd have to wait till May to get into the area. But what could I do? I mean, what can you do for all that time? And the only thing I could do is pray. And so, you know, I mentioned that her early in the year that I had come to the conclusion my brother had died. And many of you asked, you know, what they could do. And, of course, the only thing any of us could have done was pray. And so I made it a point that I was going to pray specifically every day for the ability to find my brother. And what I also decided I was going to do was that I was going to convince God that he needed to do this. And in order to convince God, I had to come up with reasons why you should do this for me. And so I would go through the scriptures and I would read and I would find things that would pertain to this topic. And I'd say, God, okay, you said this and you said that. And you want us to do this. And, you know, even though it's the firstborn's responsibility to do this, if it falls on me, Father, I want you to do this for me because it would be my responsibility. Other things that I did is I spent hours on Google Earth. If you've ever been on Google Earth, it's somewhat addictive in a way. But I knew the coordinates of where the truck was found. I'd not been to the area, but I knew the coordinates of where the truck was found. And I guess I was hoping beyond hope, but I was get to that spot and then I would span out and then I would home in as close as I could just to see if I could see someone walking. Because Google Earth, you know, those pictures are taken at periodic times and just maybe a coincidence, it would be a picture taken of someone walking out there. And so I would take a little areas and I would just, anyway. So I was looking for my brother at the best I could. I also tried to get my prayer patterns set up to where I was meeting, saying my prayers at the time of the morning and evening sacrifices. And because as we saw in Scripture, as we've seen in Scripture, many things happened due to the prayers that were prayed at the time of the morning and evening sacrifices. Some of the verses that I had seen that I used to try to convince God that he needed to do something for me was this verse right here, Genesis 3:19. Yeah. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you shall be taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. So I told God, my brother's not dust yet, and so he needs to go back into the ground. He needs to go into the ground. He's not there yet. I talked to him about this passage here. My father made me swear, you know, how Joseph wanted so much to bury his father. I'm about to die. This is quoting Jacob. I am about to die in my tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan. There shall you bury me. Now, therefore, let me please go up and bury my father. So here's Joseph pleading to be able to go bury his father. And I said, God, please, you know, let me go bury my brother. So I threw these things out at God and talked to him about these things. I also talked to him about how my brother wasn't a criminal. My brother didn't have a police record at all, which is a little bit frustrating for the police when they found him because he had no fingerprints that they could match up. And so, but you know what we see in Scripture is that in pagan cultures, criminals are left out to be food for the animals. And this scripture here came to mind. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift your head from you. Of course, this is the baker or the butler. And hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat the flesh from you. That's the baker. So, you know, here's my brother out there, and he's food for the birds. But he wasn't a criminal. So, you know, we need to get him down from there because he's not a criminal. And I contrasted this to what God says. God says that if a man has committed a crime punishable by death and he is put to death and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night on the tree, but you shall bury him the same day. So I said, God, you know, he's not a criminal. I need to get him down from this place, get him to the ground. You've got to help me get this, you know, do it. So I tried to put a guilt trip on God, you might say, and tell him that, you know, you've told us to do certain things, so therefore I want you to help me to do these things. And I guess I was somewhat, you know, in his face in many ways. So I knew it was God's will for my brother to be buried, and as a brother, I knew it was his or my family's responsibility to see to it that it got done. Therefore, my prayers included that reminder that I'm wanting to fulfill my responsibility as an Israelite and as a brother to find my brother and put him in the ground. So when May arrived, it was a Tuesday. My wife was coming back from visiting her parents on Tuesday, that same Tuesday. So I called Eric up in Colorado and I said, Eric, remember you said come back in May? Well, it's May. I'm coming. And he says, you really are going to come back up here? And I said, yes, I'm going to search for my, are you going to come up here? Not back. I've never been there before. He said, you'll never find him up here. And he said, but you're welcome to come. And so Angie got in that afternoon, and at 3 o'clock the next morning, I was on my way to Colorado. I caught an airplane out of Dallas and headed up there. So we got into Denver and called Eric along the way and told him that I was there. You know, when can I meet with you? And he says, I'll meet you tomorrow morning at 9:30 in Norwood, Colorado. And so I drove up into the night and it ended up staying in a hotel in a little town called Montrose, Colorado, which is right at the foot of the mountains. And I got there and went out and got something to eat. And that night I sat there and I was trying to think, what can I do? I mean, I was anxious, you know, I was antsy, wanting to get on down there, you know. And so I decided I was going to pray about it. And so I prayed probably one of the most heartfelt prayers I ever prayed, probably as much as I did when my wife had some problems back some years ago. And anyway, so I got down on my knees and I prayed. And remembering that the word yada, to give thanks, is outstretched arms, I had my arms out the whole time. And I prayed to God and I said, God, I'm getting ready to go into an area where they've told me I'll never find him, my brother. I said, I'm going to have direction. You've got to give me direction. And I again went through all the reasons why he should do this for me. And then I said, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to be as bold as Gideon. I said, you put these examples in there for us to use, not just look at. And I said, so I'm going to be as bold as Gideon, and I'm going to tell you what I want. And I want you to do it. And I said, what I want is I'm going to go down there tomorrow, and when I'm ready to start my search, even though it wasn't intended, I did not intend to search the whole time that I was there, but when I start my search, I want to see an airplane fly overhead going the exact direction I need to start looking. And I did that because I knew airplanes. Okay, it's something familiar to me. And Gideon, I felt like new sheep. And so he put a fleece out there, something he knew. He knew that a fleece is not going to be wet or dry at a particular time. He knew something. So I knew airplanes fly overhead, and I knew they leave contrails. And a contrail, by the way, is a vapor trail that's behind the airplane. You've all seen them. They look like clouds. That's called a contrail. And I knew that if God would send a airplane over, and even if it was a small airplane like mine, if it was a small airplane, it would be lower, and I can know exactly which way he's going anyway. But if it was going to be a jet, I needed to see a contrail. So I got, and I prayed about it, and I said, God, this is what I want. And so the next morning I got up, met Eric down there at 9:30 in Norwood. He took me another hour and 15 minutes down to where my brother's truck was. I followed him, and we searched around down there in the area. He showed me where my brother's truck was. He showed me where he had smashed his computer and then tried to burn it and all that stuff. And he showed me the beer bottles that were scattered around. My brother drank a six-pack of beer that evening. And just showed me all these things that they knew of. And he showed me where they had searched, or some of the places they had searched. They had searched a lot of areas. But he says, quite frankly, I can't tell you what to do. He says, there's just no clues to where he's at. There's just no clues. He and I went out and we started searching around. And we were looking under rocks and looking behind trees and all this stuff. And one of the things we did come up on was a bear track. and it was a fresh bear track. And Eric said, it's either a bear or it's a large mountain lion. I don't know for sure. But he says, and it was fresh. And he says, so you should be careful around here. Don't get very far away from your truck. I didn't have a gun or anything with me. And anyway, so I came back to the truck, we both came back to the truck, and then Eric had to go back to work. He had to go on, he had other responsibilities. So he headed out, and the last thing he told me is, he says, if you go out looking for your brother, don't get on the boulders, because if you get on the boulders and you fall, then we're going to be having two missing bodies out here. Because it's outside of cell phone range, you'll never get hold of them. When you get out to the boulders, it was outside of cell phone range. At least he thought it was. And so he said, just don't do it. And he said, give me a call when you get back on the main road. So I said, all right, I'm just going to be here for a few minutes, and then I'm going to go. So Eric left, and I got on my knees. And I prayed about it. And I said, God, and actually I'd forgotten about the sign I'd asked for. But I just said, God, help me. What am I supposed to do here? This area is much bigger than I thought. I thought there would be some clues and stuff here to where he's at, but there's nothing here. I can't see anything to tell me what to do. And so I said, God, you're going to have to show me what to do. So I said, just let me know. Should I continue this, or should I, search? Should I come back up here? Should I just go home and realize it's a lost cause? Didn't even think about the sign. But as soon as I got up, there was a jet flying right over. And it had the biggest, fattest, longest contrail I'd ever seen. And it stretched almost all the way back to the horizon, which is probably 20 miles back to the horizon. And so I looked up at it, and I said, is that a sign? And being a skeptic, I said, I don't know if that's a sign or not. But nevertheless...
Thank you.
No, I was somewhat of a skeptic. So, nevertheless, what I did is I got my cell phone out, and it had a little compass thing on it, and I got it and I lined it up with that contrail, and I realized that the airplane was flying in a heading of 240 degrees, which is southwest. And so I started thinking, and I said, I did ask for a sign. So I better take this as a sign. And so I just started following it, and then I started following it quicker and quicker, and I saw myself running. And I was following this path, and actually the heading was parallel with a pipeline right-of-way. We call them right-of-ways down here. They call them cuts up there. So I was following this pipeline cut, which was about 30 yards wide, and it was a reclaimed cut, which meant that they put all the boulders back on top of it and all that stuff. So it was just like going over a garbage dump in many ways. It was just all these rocks and trees and everything all over the place. But it was parallel with this, it was parallel with the 240 degree heading. And it was much easier to go that way than it was to go right through the woods that I would have been facing otherwise. And so I stepped over 15 yards into this cut and started following this cut. And this cut was going 240 degrees, and I kept following it. And I went about a mile down that cut, and I got to a point where I saw that the cut turned off to the left. And right in front of me was this big wall of boulders. And it was part of this mesa. The mesa had about a 500-foot tall mesa there, and it was all boulders that had fallen off of this mesa there, and there, all these boulders were in front of me. And so I didn't know what to do. I mean, the heading was, if it was indeed a sign, the heading was 240 degrees. It wasn't back over to the east or anything like that. It was southwest. But if I was going to go southwest, I was going to have to go right up that mountain of boulders. So what I did is I prayed about it again. And I got back on my knees, and I prayed about it. And I said, God, if indeed you gave me a sign, which I'm assuming is a sign, and I'm acting as if it's a sign, then I need another one, because I don't know where to go. I'm lost again. I don't know which way to go. Do I go out to the east and follow the cut, or do I climb the boulders? And so I got up And just as I got up, I was facing east when I was praying. I got up and I started searching the sky. And when I got over to the southwest, an airplane flew right over the top of that mesa. And it had a contrail. And I said, this is more than coincidence. So I got my camera out and I took a picture of it. Because I wanted to remember right where I was at, I took a picture that showed the trees I was standing by when I took the picture so I could see exactly where I was at. And then I decided, well, I'm going to go ahead and search a little bit that way. So I started heading down in that area, but the boulders were all over the place. And I found myself climbing on the boulders, doing what I shouldn't have been doing. And I looked at my cell phone, no cell phone service, and I said, I'm going to get myself killed out here. And about that time, I remember there's mountain lions or bears out in this area. So I started walking back, started heading back toward the car, and I said, okay, I've got recorded where I was at. I've got the sign up there, and I'm going to head back. So I got back to the car, and I called Jason, told him that I was back. Actually, Jason called me and said, Dad, where are you? And so I said, well, I'm back. So I came on back home. So I just want to take and jump in here a little bit more about some things about signs here. You know, oftentimes it takes more than one sign to convince us that God is actually giving us a sign. And for me, that was the case. You know, I wasn't convinced the first time that it was a sign, but I was convinced the second time that it was a sign. And we don't have to look at that as unbelief. We don't really have to look at that as unbelief, because God knows us and He makes accommodations for us. Oftentimes, because of our initial unbelief, we'll discount the rest of the signs. And we'll say, okay, you know, this couldn't be a sign. So even though God's got another sign prepared for us, we're not in the position to receive the sign. So it's important that when we ask for signs, then if we get something we think might be a sign, we follow through, because He may have another sign ready for us down the road. We just don't know. This is a problem that Israel faced. Even though Israel was in Egypt and they longed for a deliverer, when the deliverer came along, they could not accept it. Thus Yahweh gave them signs to help their unbelief and to get their attention. And so we've got this passage right here in Exodus 4. It says, then Moses answered, and behold, honey, can you give me a little bit of water? Behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, Yahweh did not appear to you. And Yahweh said to him, what is it that you're in your hand? And he said, a staff. And he said, throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses ran from it. But Yahweh said to Moshe, put out your hand and catch it by the tail. So he put out his hand and caught it by the tail, and it became a staff in his hand, that they may believe that Yahweh, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared unto you. And again Yahweh said to him, put your hand into your cloak. And he put his hand into his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then God said, put your hand back into your cloak. So he put his hand back into his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of the flesh. If they will not believe you, God said, or listen to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. And if they will not believe even those two signs, or listen to your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on dry ground, and that water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. So here God's making accommodations for their not accepting the first sign, or even the second sign. And we know that Moses did pour out the water on the ground, and the Nile did turn to blood. So apparently Israel didn't receive the signs. And maybe the reason that Israel had to go through the first three plagues was because they were unwilling to accept the signs. I don't know for sure, but we do know.
Well, yes. The magician's copied. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, sometimes you think, you know, there's a way. way that Satan's yeah. right, but it might, you know.
Yeah. But I tell you what, yes, they did, but that, well, I'm just going to throw you in a sidebar here on this, and that is the magicians were able to duplicate what God did on those first two signs. But if God, if the Israelites had rejected the magicians and just simply said, these are signs from our God, then they may not have had to go through the plagues. If we reject the signs, then oftentimes God will give us other signs. But we should not be concerned that if we aren't sure about the first sign, that we don't follow through with it. If we're asking for a sign from God and we see any inkling of the sign, we should follow through, because God will more than likely provide another sign down the way to take and solidify our beliefs. David was a man who knew the importance of signs. In a prayer for mercy in his times of trouble, David asked for a sign that would show his enemies that David was king. And he said, show me a sign of your favor that those who hate me may see and be put to shame because of you, Lord. Have helped me and comforted me. So David himself wanted signs, because not only does a sign help you as far as your faith, but it helps you to realize that God's in agreement with you. When God gives you a sign, that's an indication that He agrees with what you're doing or what you want to do. So it's good to have that. All right, so going back to the story, I got back from Colorado back last Friday, two Fridays ago, and this past Sunday, Angie and I took off to go up to Colorado. But before we took off to Colorado, we had a little problem. That is that my brother and my sister, who had previously agreed to go up there, in fact had said they definitely wanted to go up there, both backed out. But I had to make some additional preparations because they weren't going. For one thing, I thought that, well, four of us together, we would probably be safe up there. But now I had to arm myself, and so I had to get my deer rifle out and my handgun out and get
bear
some
rifle?
Bear rifle. It wasn't a bear rifle.
Lion rifle.
No, it wasn't a lion rifle either. It was just a little deer rifle. So I got my deer rifle out and my handgun and said, well, you know, there's no sense in going up there unarmed, and there's no sense in tempting God in many ways, even though I was very confident that I wouldn't need them, because if God was had taken me this far, and if it indeed was signs, then He's going to see me all the way through. But I took them anyway and got up there. Because they backed out on me, I called a fellow up. I called Eric Berg, the sheriff's department guy up there. And I said, Eric, you know, my family's backed out on me. They're not going to help me in this search. It's just me and my wife. Do you know of anybody that I could hire from your department that would be off duty that I could, you know, go up there with? And he said, well, just coincidentally, we're having a meeting tonight of the search and rescue department. And he says, well, I'll mention this. So I didn't hear back from Eric, but the next day Jason put on my desk that someone had called from the sheriff's department and wanted to talk to me. So I called the guy back, and the guy's name was Chris White. And Chris was the guy that I had first talked to when I was started my inquiry into how to take care of this problem up there. And Chris said, talked to Eric last night. He says, you're going to try to find your brother. And he says, I would like to go, but he said, I can't. But I have a brother who can go. And I talked to my brother, and he said he would be glad to go. So just give him a call and send him an email letting him know the area you're going to search, so he can try to get some maps out. He knows that area pretty well. And he said, so Eric, my brother will be glad to go up there. The only problem was is I called his brother a number of times, and he never returned my call. And so Sunday morning, in fact, on Saturday night, I emailed Chris, and I said, Chris, your brother never has gotten in touch with me. And he says, well, I'll call my brother right now and tell him to call you. But he never did. His brother never called me. And so when Angie and I left the house on Sunday morning, it was just me and her, and we had nobody to help us. But we were determined we're going to go up there anyway. So we drove all through the day, and about we got to our where we were intending to stay that night at about 9:30 on Sunday night. And I had been out of cell phone range for quite a while, but when I got back into cell phone range, I looked at my cell phone and saw that Chris had emailed me, Chris White. And he said, call me at this number. So we're pretty close to the hotel, so we got into the hotel, and I called that number, and Chris said, my brother is right here with me. He wants to go. And I said, oh, really? And he said, yep. And so I talked to his brother, and his brother is saying, oh, I've been trying to get hold of you guys, but he says, you never did send me your phone number. And he said, we didn't know how to get hold of you. And I said, well, I called you a number of times. And he said, yeah, but my cell phone for the last two or three days has just not worked up in this area. And so he said, but I want to go. And he said, what do I need to do? And I said, well, we're here, you're there, and we'll meet right here. And he said, I told him it's going to take me an hour and a half to get up there. So let's meet tomorrow morning at 9:30 at the Basin store, which is the store right at the edge into this long dirt road. And just coincidentally, Eric or Chris's brother's name was Joshua. So I met Joshua that morning. He seemed like he was a kid, though he was 35 years old. And he followed us out this long dirt road. We finally got to a point. I was in my pickup. He was in this little short, small car. It was real low to the ground, so we got to a point where he could not go any further without bottoming out. So he got in the car with us, and he loaded his guns. He had guns with him, too, his backpack and all that stuff, and we got him in the truck. And so we got up there to where my brother was. So we got out of the truck and put our backpacks on and slung our rifles over our arms and our handguns and our holsters and all that stuff. And we were getting ready to go, and Eric had all these, or Josh had all these maps. And he says, now this area here would be good, and this area would be good, and this area would be good. And I said, Josh, I know exactly where I want to go. And he said, where? And I said, where this picture is. And just coincidentally, I had sent Chris, or Joshua, in an email, a coordinates of exactly where I thought my brother was, and a detailed story about what I had seen so far and the signs of the airplanes. And he knew that, but he didn't really believe I was going to do this. And I said, Chris, you know, I told you about the airplane, or Josh told you about the airplanes. I said, I'm going to follow these signs. So I said, let's go down this cut. So we got all our, Angie and I and Chris got our, Josh got our packs on, and we started heading down this pipeline cut. Angie said I was going pretty fast. I didn't think I was. But I was moving along pretty good, I guess. And we got down to where I had taken the picture of the second airplane, and I said, Josh says, well, are we going to look over here? And I said, no, we're going to look right up there. And I said, this is the picture. And I pulled out my cell phone, and I had the picture on my cell phone of where we were supposed to go. In fact, I should have this picture up there right now. I said, this is the picture I showed him. And I said, you see that contrail up there? And I said, that's a jet contrail, and that came over right when I asked for a sign. And I said, so we're right here. We're right there where those clump of trees are. I said, we're going to go up to where that is. And I said, he said, so we need to get our bearings, and our bearings are those trees up there. So we're going to walk directly up to those trees, and we're going to search along the way. And he said, fine, let's go. And he was a young, energetic man, and he was ready to go. So we started taking off, and we started walking up there, and we were searching everywhere. And I mean, these boulders were everywhere, and there was a million places to hide. And even though we were just going just as straight as we could up there, there was so many places to hide. But we kept going on, and we going on. And in that picture, if you go maybe as you can see from this point here. Let's see. If you see from this point right here to the top, we were about right here. Actually, we were about right over here because we couldn't see the trees, and we were about right over here. And Josh said, I think I ought to take off and try to climb the ridge and see if I can see anything from up there, and then I'll get back to you guys. And so I said, well, that sounds fine. So he took off his backpack, and I took my rifle and laid it on a rock real close to his backpack, and he took off sort of to the west, and Angie and I continued climbing. And we got up to a point right below that ridge that we saw a lot of big outcroppings with places underneath where a person could hide. And as we got up there, San Juan Mountains to the east became visible, and I mean, it was just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So we got up there and saw all these places, and
we saw, rocks?
Yeah, there were rocks hanging out,
okay.
Plus sort of made like natural caves, you know.
Okay.
And we would look all through those things, and I was climbing around on boulders and ledges and everything, trying to make sure I covered everything. And I finally got to where, as you got up there closer, you couldn't see those trees at the top. And when I finally found the trees again, I said, well, honey, we need to go back a little bit to the south. And so we started heading over to the south and looking all the time as we went. And we got to a point, and we'd been gone from Josh for about 30 minutes. And I told Angie, you know, I probably need to try to find a way to get up on top the mesa, because I'm afraid that Josh may have fallen and hurt himself, because we hadn't heard from him for a while. And so I was starting to search, trying to find a place to get on top of the mesa. And we walked along to the east, and there was this little ledge above us, and Angie looked up there and saw a water bottle. And she says, well, there's a water bottle. And then stuck her head up a little bit closer, she saw a red backpack. And she says, oh, there's Josh's backpack. He's already gone back and got his backpack and brought it up here. So we thought that Josh was right there up above us. So I started climbing up, and I looked over at the backpack when she brought it out, and I saw my brother.
Oh.
And he was right there, wedged between a rock, a big old boulder, and the cliff wall of the mesa.
Was his backpack on him?
No. It was just laid there next to him. It wasn't Josh's back. It looked like Josh's.
Red and gray, so
yeah, his was red. Yeah.
So,
so anyway, there he was. I looked up there, and I just told her. I said, "Honey, it's my brother."
Well, she actually
found
him.
No, she saw
the
water bottle. So anyway, we found him there. So anyway, we pulled the picture out, and we realized that he was right below that contrail. If you take that contrail down to where it hits the mesa there, he was right there. And so I call that the finger of God, because I think that's God pointing out exactly where I was to look. All right, so where am I at?
So how soon did you find Josh?
We hollered out and said, I hollered at Josh, and Josh heard us. He had actually gone back to get his backpack and the rifle, and he came. And I hollered and I said, Josh, I found him. I found him. And he couldn't believe it. So he came back and saw my brother there. And he says, I can't believe this. He said, this is absolutely remarkable. And I was there, and I was just shaking. I was just shaking violently almost. And you know, I don't know. I don't think I was shaking because I saw a dead body, half decomposed dead body. I think I was shaking because we had come to the realization that the God of Israel actually answered our prayer. He was right there. So Angie and I said a quick prayer there, thanking God for his for revealing this. And of course we did much more later on. So anyway, that's how it all came about. And Sheriff's Department came a couple hours later.
Did you stay there?
Oh, yeah. Sheriff's Department came and extracted the body and did their detective work to get him. And brought a helicopter out to get him off the mesa and all that stuff. So it was quite something. But I just want to conclude with the story of Gideon. And we're going to talk about Gideon next week. In the judges, Gideon asked for actually three signs in his lifetime that we know of. One was when the angel of God came along, and he wanted to know who the angel of God was, and so he asked for a sign, and he had brought out some food, and the angel of God just poof with smoke, fire, devoured all of that. But that was a sign that Gideon didn't ask specifics about. He just asked for a sign, and God delivered the sign of his choosing. But as a result of that sign, Gideon did go on and do what God had told him to do, which is tear down this altar. But he was afraid to do it by himself, so he asked for help to go do it, and God allowed him to take help with him to do this job. But it specifically says that he was afraid. But that was just the start for Gideon, because Gideon later on had another job to do, and that was to drive the Midianites out of Israel. But in that case, Gideon asked for a sign, but this time he was specific about his sign. And so God gave him the sign that he was asking for, and then Gideon asked for another sign, and God gave him another sign, a very specific sign. Both times it was specific what he had asked for. But after receiving that second sign, you couldn't stop Gideon. He went on, and he took, and of course God whittled his army down to a very, very small army against the entire Midianite army. And Gideon was able to destroy and drive out the entire Midianite army out of Israel. But it is because Gideon asked for a specific sign, and God gave it to him. He was bold enough to tell God, "This is what I want, and this is why I want it, and it's for to do your will that I want to do that, that I want this sign. So give me the sign," and God gave him the sign. I've learned a lot about signs these past few months. Signs and prayer are intertwined. You've got to convince God you need a sign, and then God will give it to you. You need to ask for something that is within God's will, that something that He can agree with, because that's what the word means, to be in agreement. And so you should be specific in not only what the sign is, but be specific in what you intend to do with the sign. Because, and I'll just tell you now, when I ask God for a sign to do this, and what I've been praying about this whole time was not just to find my brother. It was to find my brother and get him buried. And to be at his graveside when he's resurrected. Those are the three things I've asked for. So you need to be specific in asking for a sign, and be specific about why you're asking for it. And then ask for something that you can easily recognize. You know, don't ask for something you're not going to be able to recognize. I asked for an airplane. I know airplanes. So I knew what I would know it when I saw it. So, and then the last thing is to believe that Yahweh has given you a sign when He's given it to you. You may not believe the first one, but just have enough faith, or just enough belief to say, okay, I'm going to follow it anyway, even if it's not a sign. Because if you take the initiative to follow the first sign, God will more than likely give you another sign to help you along the way, just like He did Gideon. So you've got to act on the sign. Just asking for a sign and then not acting on it is a wasted sign. And it could be that God is waiting to give you something else, and you're just not there to answer it. So anyway, I hope this little story and this these scriptures will help us to have a little bit different view on asking God for signs and the wonderful things that He will do for us if we just pray about it earnestly and be specific with Him. You know, God says to beat our prayers down really fine, and so sometimes we just need to do that. And He will be there, and He was there for me. So I thank you.